Talo Falava, I'm Sosef Womoli. Join me for Sister Sounds, a music show dedicated to showcasing the breadth of talented female musicians and performers from across the Pacific. Sister Sounds will bring you amazing local talent mixed with the sounds and vibe our Islander audiences love by artists from across the seas as well. Search up ABC Sister Sounds to listen online or find it in the ABC Listen app.
This is an ABC podcast.
This is Stories from the Pacific on ABC Radio Australia.
Hello and welcome to Stories from the Pacific. I'm Wendy Mockey. Born of Fijian heritage, but raised in the heart of Western Sydney, Isaac Nasedra accidentally stumbled into environmental forensics due to a university admissions error, only to discover a lifelong calling to protect the Pacific. From running for state parliament in Sulu to challenging the status quo of polite activism, Isaac is on a mission to prove that Pacific Islanders are not just performers for consumption, but thinkers, philosophers, and political forces. Isaac Nasedra, welcome to Stories from the Pacific.
No, thanks for having me.
You grew up in the suburbs of Western Sydney. How did you navigate that specific multicultural melting pot? How did that shape your understanding of community?
It's a blessing growing up in Western Sydney because you get exposed to all these different cultures and it becomes like this melting pot. And even though there is a lot of divisiveness, there is strength in diversity. And you can see that with all like the lovely foods and the lovely languages and different cultural protocol that you get to experience. You wouldn't normally get to experience in like a monoculture. It's, yeah, understanding that our culture can be whatever we need it to be, however we need it to be, and it can be shaped into different contexts, you know, depending on the society that you're in, you know, but also understanding that, you know, you still have to contribute to community in your own way. And that's why I'm so grateful to have my Melanesian background, my Fijian background in that way, because, you know, I could share my experiences and also experience all these other cultures that I'm privy to. So no, it's been a blessing. A lot of people do like to look down on Western Sydney. It's crazy.
That is crazy.
We don't get the best rap in terms of, like, you know, certain issues that are common. Yeah, you know, gang violence, postcode wars, all of that. And I think a lot of that gets misconstrued in the media to, you know, further creates this divide in society. And it's just simply not the case. When you grow up in a culture like Western Sydney, we have more similarities than differences. And those differences only make us stronger.
Paint a picture for us of your family household. I'm wondering who was around the dinner table and where did you fit into in the family lineup as a young boy?
I think I was a bit of the black sheep and like of the family. Yeah, 100%. I was a bit of a rebel, bit of a crybaby. Yeah, and I think people would still agree that I'm a bit of a crybaby. I like to pick up a stink every now and then. And I wear that unapologetically. Like, we need a crybaby in every family.
Every shout out to all the crybabies.
100%. Thank you, all the crybabies out there. So that was me growing up. Her older sister, three younger brothers, and mum and dad. Sister was always like the strong, like elder woman, the eldest daughter, sort of mold, you know, does all the work, doesn't really complain all that much, and you know, carried a lot of the familial burdens. So I'm really shout out to my sister for, you know, holding it down for the whole family. Yeah, it was a typical Islander family. And dad was always working, like he's no longer with us, but, you know, working two jobs and, you know, only coming home for like a couple hours a day just to shower and change and go to the next job. And mum was around cooking and doing all the other stuff and would be helping around cleaning and keeping everything tidy and looking after our little brothers and stuff. So I think a lot of Pacific families can resonate with that sort of a household. It's molded me to be the man I am today.
Were there any particular lessons or advice that maybe mum and dad might have instilled in you as a as a young boy that has really kind of stayed with you? What are some of the important lessons that they've left with you?
Let's see, my dad, I think watching him like just be himself, developed a strong work ethic from him. And well, I didn't have the best relationship with him. I still don't have the best relationship with my mom, but I can appreciate, I guess now after like a lot of therapy, seeing like all the trauma that she's been through and her trying to, you know, raise her family in a completely new world, trying to do her best without inflicting as much trauma, but still inflicting trauma, but not understanding the full, yeah, the full effects of what she's been doing, and understanding she's only doing her best and she's only trying to do less of what she's experienced through trauma, and try to heal her inner child. So that's something that I've had to take away from that and learn from and unlearn, do a lot of unlearning as well. And yeah, trying to live my life in a way that I no longer can keep going through those intergenerational traumas and breaking the cycle, so to speak, for my children down the line.
Yeah. And while we're on the topic of families, your grandfather was a teacher in Fiji who would bring villagers to the mainland to work on his farm so they could earn money. Is that correct?
Yeah, because he was one of the pioneers of the Seventh-day Adventist, one of the Seventh-day Adventist churches in Tamawa.
Okay.
Yeah. So, and, you know, he wanted to do something different within the main Aksuwe area. So he started a big taro farm, and whenever people from the village would come over and they needed, you know, just extra money, he'd offer like a place to stay back at the farm and let them work on the farm and earn a bit of cash so they can do whatever they wanted to, whether they were like studying or just wanted to come for the weekend and need a bit of extra money to kind of go to the clubs. Not that he'd know, being a strict Seventh-day Adventist like elder. Yeah. But yeah, whenever they needed money for whatever, he was always just happy to help. And I think one of the biggest lessons I learned from that was, I remember one time while he was on the farm, a lot of his stuff got stolen. And yeah, and we'd tell him like, oh, like, you know, a lot of his stuff's getting stolen. What's happening? I was like, oh, that's fine. Like, if people stole my equipment, they must have needed it for something. So I can always go back and buy more equipment, but they might have needed it a bit more than I did. So like not just tools, but like all the cows on his farm, some of the taro, even stuff from inside the house that got stolen. Like, people knew who was stealing it. He just didn't really mind.
Yeah.
As long as they were okay at the end of the day, that's all that mattered to him.
What did watching his specific type of leadership teach you about the responsibility for caring for community?
He taught me a lot. I don't know where to start off with it. Yeah. My granddad being like, he was a teacher, he was a headmaster, also developed one of the schools in Fiji as well. He was always quite selfless and he treated everyone with kindness. He had this sort of like golden retriever sort of energy whenever anyone would come into the roof. He loved the yarn. He could talk ear off. And it's just like that sort of energy that he'd bring into the room is the kind of energy I'd like to emulate. But I think I emulated more of my grandmother, which was sort of that quiet leadership and trying to lead from the back and be a great facilitator of space.
Yeah.
Rather than the center of it. And so that's something I'm learning from the way that my grandmother moved around. She was just always like making sure everyone was, you know, okay, putting food on the table, making sure everyone, you know, had a seat. If they needed a seat, everyone was okay. Didn't really say much, but I think that in itself was so powerful because she achieved so much, but she never speak about it, never. And yeah, that's kind of what I'm more emulating as well. Both great leaders in their own aspect, and I'm learning from everyone, I guess. I think you can't really become an adult without, you know, taking little characteristics from each of your family members and trying to be the best person you can from all the learnings you've made from those that have come before you.
You joke that you are one of the few Fijians that wasn't good at footy. I don't know how much that is true, but despite of that, it was actually at a rugby game where you found your life's calling. You stumbled across a stall for the Pacific Climate Warriors. Would you be able to tell us about that moment and how did a day at the footy turn into a decade of activism?
I joke, but it's true. I'm helping bring the average skill level of Fiji down. Those of us rugby. Yeah. So I need to be the outlier to normalize and
yeah. We want to lower our expectation of Fijian rugby skills. Okay, got it. Got it.
Because everyone's great and then there's me. But that aside, we went to watch one of the Pacific tests happening in Campbelltown, out in southwest Sydney. And the Pacific Comoros had a stall, and I studied environmental science at uni, but I didn't really see many Pacific Islanders in my course or my degree or in much around the sciences. So this really got me excited because the most I ever heard about like climate change in the Pacific was like watching a documentary by Ana Te Tong. That's pretty much it. I didn't really know much about it until this chance meeting at a rugby game, because you never know what's going to happen. And they were talking about, climate justice and how it's affecting all the islands. And, I've heard like a lot of this before with Cyclone Winston wiping through my Thai village. And you see the effects even as diaspora. You still face some of the effects because you got to make sure that your family is all right, your yavu, your foundation is, still standing. But to know that there was a community in Sydney that is coming together to try and fight for climate justice, to fight for our people in the Pacific and to come together for a common cause, I thought that was quite powerful. And so that's what drew me in straight away. And it was good to talk to a lot of those people and build a community around that. And that's from then on, and my trajectory of my life has just gone left, but it's been great. I've enjoyed every minute of it.
Your entry into university is also an amazing story of like a happy accident type of situation. You famously entered the wrong code on your admissions form, which is crazy. I love this. What went through your mind when you got the text saying you were enrolled in environmental forensics instead of your intended course?
Yeah, because I did want to do law, and then my mate was like, and I had high ambitions. I wanted to get into law. My mate was like, hey, have you put in your UAT codes? And I'm like, nah, not yet. I'm still trying to play. Well, I forgot what I was playing, probably COD or something. And he's like, the deadline's in like 20 minutes. I'm like, oh, I should probably do that now. So I went on to the website and then looked up all these law degrees I wanted to get enrolled into, and I was just typing in all these codes, and then I just left it, went back into the game and didn't think anything of it until 3 months later I got the text saying, congratulations, you've been enrolled into environmental forensics. I'm like, what the heck is this? I did not sign up for this. This is not for me. I could not care one bit about the environment. I wanted to get into law. I wanted to check out criminology or something. And then I'm like, you know what? We have the census date. So we have 3 weeks to do a course, and if we don't like it, we can unenroll without having to pay any fees. And then from the first lecture, we had this one lecturer, very passionate, and he was talking about, how all the problems in society starts off with the environment. And so that really got me thinking. I'm like, this is actually really important. I think I'm going to stick with it. And so I've stuck with it ever since.
Honestly, that's one of the most Pacific Islander things to have happened to anybody.
True.
You've also spoken about the isolation of being at a university, being one of only 30 Pacific Islanders at the University of Technology in Sydney. I'm wondering, how important was it finding a mentor in navigating that specific kind of cultural loneliness?
It was really important. Having that stereotype where Islanders don't belong at university. You know how when you're during your O-week or whatever, people are handing out flyers for whatever, discount textbooks or the local bars giving out student coats or whatever. All my friends would get all these flyers. They'd be handing them out, trying to hand them with all these pieces of rubbish paper. And whenever they look at me, they're just step back, and they wait for the rest of the friends behind me to shoot the pieces of paper. I'm like, wow. People really don't expect me to be at university. I think having finding a community in ETS Pacifica where it wasn't just students, but also employees of the university that were involved in like building this community. I think that was really important to find your own people in like this big sea of, you know, academic struggles. Yeah, I'm totally grateful for what we've been able to build and what, in fact, even now, what UTS Pacifica has been able to do with all the events that they're doing and all the outreach and all the, yeah, they're doing amazing work. So super proud of UTS Pacifica and what's been going on. But yeah, you need a group of friends or a community while you're studying because it's stressful. It's hella stressful.
Now, you took a detour into politics in 2023, running as a candidate in Bankstown. You said you wouldn't run again, but you would manage a campaign. Why is the role of kingmaker now more appealing to you than being a candidate?
I ran in the seat of Bankstown, and they have a really strong candidate that's been serving there for a long, long, long time. And I knew there was absolutely no way I was going to challenge that. But I saw that there was a gap in representation within the political world, that we have such diverse people within society, but we have a parliament that doesn't reflect that diversity, at least at that time. And so I wanted to show, like, if I could at least run, then maybe other people could see that and be like, hey, this is a space for us. Like, we can do this if we wanted to. And so I just wanted to run for that first time just to show that we can do that. But I personally wouldn't want to run again because it's not really my cup of tea to be in the forefront of all these things. I'd like to advise, I'd like to manage, just because I think it's important that, you know, we don't just, you know, hold the baton for ourselves, but rather pass it on so someone else can finish that race. And if we can help them as much as we can, then we have more chance of succeeding, more chance of getting a representation, and more chance of, yeah, finishing that metaphorical race of being for our people, by our people over there.
You founded the Velomani Project to empower Pacific youth leadership. Mm-hmm. How does this project specifically work to turn young Pacifica people into policy shapers on the global stage?
It's designed in a culturally nuanced way to ensure that our Pacifica youth can become the leaders if they want to. So there's no like strict guideline. There's no strict pipeline into a particular field. It's more understanding that justice is intersectional. So even if your passion might be in climate change, understanding that there are so many common threads to pull from to build your community, understanding the links between climate change and, you know, inequalities in gender rights, queer rights, racism, Indigenous sovereignty. A lot of these issues are connected. And so by finding empowered youth, or empowering youth rather, to fight for a cause that they're passionate about, they're able to empower other people through common threads to fight for their own causes and to, you know, build up a community that way. And it's just about allowing them to find their own feet in their own way, but also understanding that it's culturally safe. So if we want to, you know, have a discussion around Atano with a bowl of kava, then so be it. It's just understanding that we need to lead in our own way rather than be pushed into the mold that, you know, Western society tells us to do.
And you successfully sent two youth delegates to the UN Climate Change Conference in Brazil. Why is it critical that the diaspora, you know, those of us living in the belly of the beast, are the ones holding the West accountable?
I think it's important because the diaspora act as the conduit between those in our islands and people within the Western context, because we understand how to navigate Western pressures and societal norms and the different cultures that come with living in the diaspora, but we also understand that what's culturally needed to be appropriate for those back home. And by being that conduit, we can make sure that, you know, these spaces are meaningful for those back home to come into, and make sure that white people understand what needs to be done to make sure that whatever they're running is culturally appropriate. And eventually that'll become our role to ensure that, you know, these spaces are as safe as possible and as effective as possible for Pacifica people and within the Western context.
Now, you have a vision of proliferating the Velomani model across the entire Australian landscape. What does that dream look like in 5, 5 years or 10 years. I'm wondering, what are those future leaders, what are they doing that isn't happening now?
It's a simple concept, just to love one another, to, you know, build a community, to show harmony and to lift each other up. It's a basic concept of Elon. And so it's understanding that, you know, we aren't just individuals living in a community. We are a community of individuals. So it's, I guess, like thinking of the teachings of other philosophers like Bernard Narokobi, even Jean-Marie Chibal from, he's a Kanaki philosopher as well, academic, understanding that we need to center ourselves in culture, in our village, and use that as our mold for leadership moving into whatever context you're in, and having more of a holistic worldview of all these, like, you know, systemic pressures and common threads with how things work. So centering the intersectionalities of justice is our way of kind of using, utilizing those holistic worldviews, and understanding that we can't just work in silos. We have to work together to achieve true justice. And that's kind of the framework I want to try and build and drill into our leaders of today. So hopefully our leaders of tomorrow can have their job a lot easier once we're able to put them there.
You stepped away from established climate groups because you refused to be silent on issues like West Papua and Palestine. Mm-hmm. Why do you believe that climate justice cannot exist without intersectional justice for all occupied people?
So I did need to step away from some climate organizations because I didn't feel like they were portraying the Pacific holistically. Like, some organizations would ask us not to talk about West Papua, and for good reason, because they might have teams in Indonesia, or in other words, that might get affected by all the turmoil and all the atrocities happening in the region. So it was trying to navigate, you know, having these conversations about West Papua, but understanding that you can't really talk about the Pacific without including the Pacific, right? Mm-hmm, we need to talk about West Papua. We need to talk about, you know, all these, like, the effects of Christianity on our culture. We need to talk about the diversity of our culture, right? Like, we're not just, like, and like how gender violence, how prominent that is in our cultures, like having to have those conversations.
They're complex spaces to navigate, but also it can be quite the emotional sort of load to have to navigate people, communities and groups. How do you then maintain your own mental health whilst doing all this work?
Well, Carver helps. But it's just honestly like understanding that you can't shoulder all this responsibility on your own. It's a big ask to kind of decolonize the systems that we're in at the moment. And to ask for a shift like that requires a lot of manpower, requires a lot of energy. And it's just not something that one person can do on their own. So a lot of the basis of modern day advocacy should be built on building a community and empowering those that want to be involved but don't really have the access to. And I feel like a lot of our community haven't really had access to a lot of these advocacy spaces. A lot of people do like to gatekeep, and it's just understanding the power of, you know, sharing the mic and, you know, just once again, just talking about common threads. You know, a lot of us talk about climate, but they don't want to talk about Palestine because of a lot of reasons. You know, religion, there's that misconception of Zionism and Judaism, and as well as, you know, the military-industrial complex that's causing so much pollution in, you know, war times. But no one wants to have those conversations because it might conflict with a luxury that they might have already. So it's important that we lead with love and understanding, because a lot of people have grown up a certain way and may not want to give up those luxuries straight away. So it does require a lot of patience too. And understanding that and taking it slow and taking the breaks that we need to, and just being real honest with yourself. If you need therapy, you know, therapy is not a bad thing. Highly recommend it, just to have someone professional to talk to and it can help dissect, you know, all the thoughts that you're having, because I guarantee you're not the only person to have those thoughts. But it's important that you talk about it, whether even if it's not a therapist, that you have a community a group of friends that will help you out with that. It's not weak to speak. It's actually very healthy. So I want to encourage everyone to try and, you know, find their own niche or their community. Even if you want to reach out to me or whoever, like, people are one would rather, you know, listen to your concerns than to have to talk in like a eulogy for you. It's one of those things that we really need to step up as people that want to talk about a community.
Yeah, thank you. That's so important to hear. And I think a lot of our listeners will be able to connect with that, but I hope that they also find a lot of strength in that as well and options, you know, if they're in a place that that they need to hear that. So thank you for speaking to that. You've also said that you don't want our Pacific people to only be seen as just people who sing and dance. You want us to shape policy and be taken seriously as thinkers. When did you first notice that imbalance, I guess, like that our culture is celebrated, but our intellect is almost sidelined?
I think it was coming into these climate spaces. I just started to notice more and more, like they would invite us to do like a meke or a siva, and then that would be the end of our contribution. And then all of a sudden, there are all these like academic experts or people that don't know much about our culture speaking on our stories. And it would happen more and more. And it just got really frustrating. And it's been a struggle to make society understand that we're more than just dancers and speakers and footy players. I mean, they're all great. They all have a place and they all play an important role. But at the same time, you know, we have orators, we have thinkers. And I think it's on us to make it appropriate to speak up and speak out against traditional norms. Because a lot of the times, our people are made to feel sidelined, othered for having a different thought than the cultural norm. And like I said in the beginning, diversity is such a strong tool in advocacy, in any sort of movement building. And to have a diversity of thought is powerful. But when we as a people sideline people for having those different thoughts, then it only weakens us as a people.
You, Isaac, are currently, you are in the fork in the road, navigating what is next for you. When you look past the uncertainty, what is the one clear ambition that keeps pulling you forward?
I guess just wanting to build a better future for those to come. It's the whole, you know, planting the seeds so the next generation can enjoy the shades of our labor. That's essentially what we want to do. In the event that I have children, I'd like them to not struggle as much and to give them an opportunity to take us to the next step. Like, I can only do so much, and this generation can only do so much. We can do our best, but it's our job to make it easier for the next generation to take us that step further. And so that's always been my MO, to think about how we can make things better, how if we can build our community outwards rather than keep everything inwards and exclusive. So that's been a tough road to navigate, but I think it's those roads that need to be navigated to take us to where we need to be.
I know you want to build a climate movement that doesn't just fight for emissions, but for West Papua, for Kanaki, for all of us. Mm-hmm. If you could snap your fingers and change one thing about how the Pacific diaspora fights for justice today, what would it be?
I think it will be understanding the importance of centering marginalized voices. And then that means ensuring that those that don't necessarily have access to the table are given access. And that means like Pacific diaspora in rural areas, Pacific diaspora that, you know, aren't part of these communities that always get the limelight. It's about sharing that space, giving the mic to the voiceless, you know, people that might not be the best singers, dancers, movers, but do have a different train of thought that they might like to express, or might have an idea that we otherwise wouldn't.
Isaac, I know you might joke about being an accidental scholar or a reluctant politician, but there is nothing accidental about the impact you are making. Thank you for doing the heavy lifting to clear a path for others and for demanding that the world respects the Pacific mind just as much as it enjoys the Pacific spirit. That was Isaac Nasedra, a strategist, a storyteller, and a true leader who is reminding us that we are not just here to make up the numbers, but to write the rules. You've been listening to Stories from the Pacific. I'm Wendy Mockie.